Chapter 9, The Key to Releases. Darlene and I pulled our VW van away from my folks' house where we had been living and headed east towards Springfield. The late November weather was not likely to be good as we drove toward Missouri, but it couldn't be worse than what we'd experienced with Hurricane Cleo. Dar and I had a lot of mixed emotions as we left my parents' house that morning. We were sad because of news from Aunt Sandra. Just a few days earlier, we had learned that she had cancer. We all called back immediately to assure her that we were praying for her. How glad I was that 8 years ago I had decided to try to get back in touch with family while on that singing tour in Miami. On a happier note, we were looking forward to the upcoming visit with the General Superintendent of the Assemblies of God, Thomas Zimmerman. I could just imagine his excitement when we outlined to him what we had been discovering, that the church could in fact guide young people into effective evangelistic work. Our dream was actually working. We had opened YWAM to all denominations, but we still wanted to stay within the framework of the Assemblies of God. We'd driven straight through to Springfield. Darlene was very tired and stayed in the motel room that we had rented near Janie's college, so that we could visit with Janie and Jimmy later. "There'll be plenty of time for getting together with the people at headquarters, honey," Dar said. So I was alone as I bounded across the marble lobby and pushed the elevator button for the third floor. A few seconds later, I stepped out into the hushed, carpeted executives domain of the Assemblies of God. These men had known sacrifice in their youth. Many had pastored congregations like the one that met in a blacksmith shop during my parents' early years, so they'd be open to new ideas pioneering for missions. Reports from the Bahamas would have reached them by now. They'd know what a great job the youth had done during the summer outreach. The secretary ushered me into the superintendent's office. "Hello, Brother Zimmerman." Brother was a special term of respect used in our denomination to underline the fact that we were all brothers and sisters in God's family. Brother Zimmerman shook my hand cordially, then sat down and looked at me across his desk. Indeed, he had heard about the Bahamian mission experiment. But if I was expecting a quick endorsement and a blank check to work interdenominationally and still maintain my standing as a minister with my church, I was mistaken. The problem, I gathered as we sat talking quietly, was that new works like ours needed to be brought under the organizational umbrella, not outside and autonomous. He said there was a place for me in the assemblies, but of course, I would have to be a full team player. In the end, I was offered a job, a good one too, there at headquarters, complete with a fine salary, a staff, and a budget. "You can continue with your vision, Lauren, but you'd be taking out a more manageable number, say 10 to 20 young people a year." My heart dropped to my knees at the very gracious offer he was extending to me. It sounded so reasonable, so secure, only it was far from what I believed God had told me to do, send out waves of young people from all denominations into evangelism all over the world. I tried to explain what I had felt God was saying to me about what was about to happen. It was much bigger than 20 kids a year, and larger than any one denomination. "Sir," I said, "there's another generation coming. It's different from anything we've ever seen." I floundered, for I could hear how foolish my reasoning sounded. Brother Zimmerman assured me that he had worked extensively with young people for decades and knew them well. As he tried to explain his reservation about my plan, I could truly see his dilemma. If I had his responsibility of leading a large movement, I would need submitted people ready to play by the rules for the good of the whole. But here I was, hearing a different drummer, out of step with my own denomination. That's more or less what Brother Zimmerman said, too. He was sorry, but I'd have to leave the team, resign, if I couldn't play by the rules. "God, is this really you?" I said to myself quickly. And I thought I heard the answer that it was His leading, indeed. I knew what I had to do. If I was really sure that God was telling me, then I had to obey and accept the consequences. Brother Zimmerman agreed, but he had no choice either. I shook hands with Brother Zimmerman, thanked him, and walked slowly, dejectedly, back to the elevator. Back across the marble floor, back out the door, aware, even as I left that building, that my decision would be forever. I was churning inside, confused about what had just happened. It was a sober time back in the motel room. Jimmy and Jenny had come over to visit and were shocked when I told them what had happened. As we discussed what had just transpired in Brother Zimmerman's office, the enormity of my decisions settled over us. "People will think I was kicked out," I said, "and preachers don't usually lose their credentials except for fooling around with women or getting caught with their hands in the till or having bad doctrine," Jenny pointed out. "What I dread the most is telling my folks," Dar said. My heart dropped a little lower. I looked at Jimmy, leaning forward in his chair, cradling his chin in a hand propped on one knee. I knew he was thinking about his own parents, too. For a long, quiet moment, we just sat there. I was going over again and again in my mind the sobering conversation I had just had with Brother Zimmerman. I clamped my jaw tightly. I was committed not to rebel, but a germ of resentment was settling into my spirit. Back in California, the word got out that I was no longer a minister with the Assemblies of God. It was difficult for Darlene and me. It was difficult for our families. But I knew that I had done the right thing. Ever since I had preached my first sermon as a 13-year-old on testing, I had gone through these challenges. I had turned down the offer of potential wealth from Aunt Sandra, giving up my reputation in my denomination, and settled for a risky and presumptuous-sounding call to send out waves of young missionaries throughout the world. After Jesus was tested in the wilderness, his ministry was released with tremendous power. Now I look forward to the future. I knew that God would not let us down. It seemed that we were poised on the launch pad, waiting for the liftoff. One event took place about 8 months after our Bahamian experience that had a strange, bittersweet quality about it. Aunt Sandra was dying. I made a special trip back east just to see her after her surgery. When she met me at the Providence Airport, it didn't seem possible that she was suffering from a vicious breast cancer. Her face was still beautiful, though paler and thinner. Her hair was carefully done, and her hands were faultlessly manicured. She wore a yellow suit, and you couldn't detect the disfigurement of her surgery. "Lauren, darling," she kissed me on the cheek, then took my arm and showed me to her limousine outside. As we drove along the streets of Providence with the trees bursting with spring green, I brought her up to date, filling her in on our future hopes for YWAM. "And how are you, Aunt Sandra?" I asked. Aunt Sandra leaned back. "I've started going to this church, Lauren. I'd like you to see it tomorrow if we have time." I certainly did. The next day, Aunt Sandra and I drove up to a colonial brick Baptist church with columns on the front. We found the big double doors unlocked and went inside to the hushed coolness. A glow from the tall windows bathed the empty pews. Aunt Sandra pointed to the choir loft. "I sing in the choir now, Lauren. It helps when I'm feeling I'm doing something for the church." She had not, I noticed, said she was singing for the Lord. I knew the time had come to do something very important. My aunt was dying and she was trying to do what was right. I had to tell her how to receive forgiveness for her sins, how to come to Jesus Christ. We slipped into one of the back pews and I just plunged ahead with what was on my heart. "Aunt Sandra, wouldn't you like to make a commitment of your life to Jesus Christ?" "Oh, yes, Lauren," she said, her eyes brimming. I spoke the phrases of a simple prayer. Aunt Sandra repeated the words after me, giving herself to God and to His care. "Dear Jesus, I do accept You as my Lord and Savior. Come into my life now and forgive me for my sins." When I left her later, I somehow knew it would be the last time I would see her in this world. It was not easy getting back in the swing of our work at YWAM. I often found myself thinking of my aunt. Partly, too, I had to confess, I was still feeling off balance after my visit to Springfield. We were totally on our own now, without the sponsorship of a large denomination, And as I looked into the future, I had no way of guessing that the launch pad we'd been looking for would turn out to be located in a tiny country around the Earth called New Zealand. It was January, but it was summertime in the Southern Hemisphere, and the sun beat down as the small seaplane flew toward my destination, a rugged campsite on an island off the coast of New Zealand. I thought back over the past 6 years since YWAM had started. 22 vocational volunteers had gone out during our first experimental years. Then a tangible glimpse of my larger dream was realized when 146 young people went out to the Bahamas and the Dominican Republic. Each year after that, additional volunteers went out during the school holidays. The waves were rising very gradually as we sent kids into the West Indies, Samoa, Hawaii, Mexico, and Central America, and yet it seemed we were missing something. "Why do we have so few full-time workers?" I asked Darlene before leaving to come on this trip.
4.5 years after our marriage, we had hundreds of short-term volunteers going out on mission trips each summer, but YWAM had only 34 full-time workers besides Darlene and me.
I yearned to see something I could only call a releasing, some tangible evidence that God was really in this dream. Maybe New Zealand would hold the answers.
Now our seaplane circled the sparkling bay, dipping to a rocky inlet on the island off New Zealand called Great Barrier.
The remote campsite curling around the water's edge at the foot of steep pine-scattered hills. Consisting of a few old buildings, a large patched meeting tent, and some smaller sleeping tents. In this camp of Christians, we intended to recruit for an upcoming YWAM outreach into the South Pacific. Our plane skimmed the water, creating a spectacular spray that obscured my vision. Jenny and Jimmy, Jenny's husband of 5 months, had come ahead of me and were waiting for me now at the rocky beach. With them were a couple in their early 40s with whom I felt immediately at home. Jim Dawson was an urbane businessman clad in the camp attire of shorts and sandals. His wife Joy's warm and bubbly patter spilled over as they led me to my accommodation. For my 2-week stay, I was given one of the luxury rooms in a line of whaler shacks.
About 150 people were at the campsite, and we were telling them about our new idea of taking young people out on mission outreaches.
After 2 weeks here on the Great Barrier Island, we planned to have a week of evangelism visiting homes in a section of New Zealand city, Auckland. Then we hoped some would join us in the South Pacific region. I had come as a speaker, but it turned out I was the one who was learning new ideas on this isolated little island. The first came from the New Zealand kids themselves. They had a guidance practice that intrigued me. In their minds, they would be given a chapter and a verse from the Bible without knowing what the reference said. Then they would consider whether or not that reading was a special guidance for whatever they were facing. "You'd be surprised how often God uses that as a way to speak," they insisted. The key, they said, was being totally submitted to the Spirit of Jesus. If he wanted to speak, he could use any tool he chose, including this quite mysterious one. I was in for some other surprises when I was invited to pray with the camp leaders. There were 5 of us, including the camp director and Jim and Joy Dawson. 4 of us were to be speakers, including Joy, but today we were going to pray over the order of the speakers. What I expected was a time of general prayer, then a discussion. Instead, one of the people explained to me, as a first-timer, that in this kind of practical guidance prayer, they would ask God to tell each person individually exactly the same thing. I tried to hide my astonishment at what I had just heard. "Okay," I thought bemusedly, "let's see what happens." "Who should be the speaker today, Lord?" the camp director prayed. I bowed my head along with the others and asked God. I confess that some not-so-spiritual thoughts flitted through my mind. What if I'm the only one who doesn't hear a thing? Or what if I get some idea that's off the wall? But the people around me were experienced Christians, and they were all fully expecting God to speak separately, giving each the same answer. So I decided I'd trust God too. I leaned back in my folding chair, but inside I was on the edge of my seat waiting to see what would happen. Then that familiar voice inside my mind said a name, one of the four around me. "Well," said the camp director, "is everyone ready?" One by one, each of us spoke out the name that had come to his mind. Each of us had heard the same thing. Five different people, yet each had the same answer. A breeze fluttered through an open window, heightening the shiver of excitement I felt inside. Day after day, we found specific guidance in this same way. I was fascinated. The other four leaders had been praying together in this manner for years, yet I felt we were on the same team. I also had a sense of belonging. Then, one day, our prayer plan didn't seem to work. We were meeting outside so we could soak up the sun while taking care of business. But this time, when we prayed, some felt I was to be the speaker, others felt it was to be Joy Dawson. I was curious to see what had gone wrong. Obviously, someone hadn't heard correctly, I thought. "It looks like we need to go back to the Lord," Joy stated matter-of-factly. She told us that Jim and she had learned that sometimes this happens, and you need to ask God if there's another factor you don't understand. So we bowed our heads for round two and asked God for clarification. Then the understanding came to each one of us. It was not Lauren or Joy, but both. First Joy, then me. This really is amazing, I thought to myself. It was like the three wise men. Each followed the star. Their individual perceptions of God's direction, and in doing so, came together to be led to Jesus. It was time to leave for the house-to-house work in Auckland. We had a lot to do to get ready for the special week ahead. I felt myself getting revved up the way I used to feel at exam times in graduate school at USC, and I knew how little time I had for the work I had to do. I also was still looking for the releases we had been praying and waiting for. Perhaps I would learn something in Auckland, some secrets of guidance I did not yet grasp, to bring those releases and to unleash the waves. Father, I prayed as our little passenger ferry was leaving Great Barrier Island for the long trip to Auckland. I'm trying to learn to listen. Please help me to see the next step you have in mind. An hour later, standing at the rail with the cold spray misting my face, I found myself thinking again of the Bible story I used for my first sermon. Jesus had been in the wilderness fasting and praying just before the beginning, the releasing, of his work on earth. I saw a pattern in this story from Jesus' life, but I tried to shrug it off. Could it be that God wanted me to give up food for a while and pray? I opened a door to the idea. "God, do you want me to go on a fast?" Immediately, the answer rushed into my brain, "Yes, and I want you to withdraw from people for 7 days, starting when you arrive." I was dumbfounded. With the house-to-house evangelism in Auckland, we had so much to do. "Am I hearing you right, God?" I asked again. Withdrawing from people meant I'd shirk my duties. Jim and Jenny would have to do the work of preparing for the outreach. The very thing we'd come thousands of miles to do. "Is this really you?" The only answer I got was another quiet voice saying, "The Dawsons are going to ask you to stay with them. Say yes." Well, that invitation was unlikely to come because the Dawsons knew I planned to stay elsewhere. If it did come, I could see God's hand more clearly. I'd know He wanted me to fast and pray, even if it meant leaving an unfair amount of work on Jimmy and Jenny. I said nothing about this to anyone and just waited to see what would happen. As the boat plowed through the waves, the sea and the sky darkened to evening. Then, just as the lights of Auckland began to glimmer on the horizon, Jim Dawson joined me at the rail. I held my breath as he began to speak. He seemed hesitant. I know you're planning to stay with other friends, but Joy and I, well, we believe we've heard something from the Lord. Would you stay with us?"